Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined in my office in Jerusalem by Lahav Harkov. And not in Jerusalem, but joining with us in this conversation is Anna Ehrenheim, the Jerusalem Post military defense correspondent, and Herb Kanan, our longtime veteran. Sorry that I always say that about you, Herb, but our veteran analyst, correspondent of many things. And we're gathering here because we're on the eve of Israel's 74th Independence Day, Yom HaTzma'ut. And we thought that it would be interesting to come together and discuss the great achievements of the State of Israel, the great challenges of the State of Israel, and also a bit about fireworks, because that's become a bit of a controversial issue. Apparently, using fireworks to celebrate a national holiday is no longer something that should be taken for granted, Lahav, right?
Right. But we said we were going to start with some happy Yom HaTzma'ut content.
Yes. So do you have a special moment in Israel, something that makes this country unique, a great achievement of the state over the last 74 years?
Well, you know, I think that in the past few months, we've seen Israel as a country really fulfilling its purpose, its raison d'etre, when there's a war in a place where there are hundreds of thousands of Jews, and they all know that they have a home and a safe place that they can go to. I mean, we, all of us in this conversation, lived outside of Israel and chose to move to Israel, you know, for various reasons, but we all thought that this was the place we wanted to live. And it's here for us, but it's also here for people in times of need. And I have right in front of me last weekend's Jerusalem Post magazine, and there's actually a quote here from Natan Sharansky. It said, "When growing up in Russia, having Jewish on your identity card was a hurdle. Now in Ukraine, it's a treasure because you have a place to go." And to me, that's what Israel is for.
Very nice. Herb, what do you think?
I think one of the great things about this period, right, we have Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and then Yom HaZikaron for the soldiers, and then Yom HaTzma'ut, is it allows you to kind of take a step away from the everyday grind of the news here and put things in perspective. And I think when you do that, you're just amazed at what this country has accomplished in 74 years. It's essentially transformed the Jewish condition. Right. Completely transformed it, fundamentally transformed who the Jews are, how they look at themselves, how the world looks at them. If you would, you know, anybody would ask their great, great grandfathers 80 years ago, if they could imagine that in the mere 80 years or 74 years, that 45% of world Jewry would be living in Israel, arguably the most powerful state in the region, economically, militarily, scientifically, they wouldn't believe it, right? They would be amazed. So the very fact that we are here, that the country is, and how it's transformed the Jewish peoplehood, to me, it's amazing. It's completely fundamentally changed the Jewish condition.
Well, I don't know if they would also, it would just be about the fact that so many Jews live here, but also just the mere existence of the State of Israel for many people. And, you know, last week, commemorating Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, I think of my grandparents who were survivors, but my grandfather often said that he never believed that there would even be a State of Israel. So that itself is also a huge achievement. Annie, where do you take this question?
I think for me, it's something that we haven't all done in a long time, but just landing in the airport, Ben Gurion, whether coming from the United States or Canada or anywhere in Europe, and you can just see the melding of all the people together, the mix of all the Jews from around the world who just came all within the past 74 years and really built this country from nothing. Even the young generation are building the country. It's such a young country that there's not one family that can say that, you know, they haven't had an impact on the country. And to me, that's what makes it so special, because it's so small, and we all really are, you know, one big family at the end of the day, and we all have a vested interest in this country. And it's just that moment you land in Ben-Gurion and then you walk out the door and that the heat of Israel hits you and the realization that, yeah, this is home. This is ours, and we built it.
The heat of Israel, the smoke fumes from the taxis and the drivers yelling at you to come take, to jump into their cab. But 100%, you know, it always, what you said is interesting because it always struck me. I remember as a kid growing up in the States and being on both sides of my grandparents, third generation second generation born in the U.S., but meeting people who like had been in, American Jews who had been there forever, right? Like 8-9 generations. Then also here, it's rare that you meet someone who's been here, you know, goes back Yerushalayim or Tzfat 10 generations, right? No?
Yeah, that's the Rivlin family. The Rivlin family. They go back to the Vilna Gaon days.
Lahav, when you think, you know, covering diplomatic affairs, when you think about the challenges that Israel has on the horizon, where do you think Israel's biggest challenge is coming ahead of its 75th anniversary next year?
Well, we can't avoid speaking about Iran this podcast, but it's diplomatic and military, of course. And I do think that that's Israel's biggest challenge. I mean, it's not just the Iran nuclear threat. It's that Iran sponsors terrorism across the region, and it sponsors, you know, it seeks to incite it against Israel and radicalizes people against Israel. And that continues to be the biggest challenge and the source of many other challenges. You know, the Palestinian issue is also a very big challenge, and it's one that no one sees a resolution to. But I think we've managed very well with the status quo maybe isn't the right way to put it. There are a lot of problems with the status quo, but certainly diplomatically, I think that we've managed to sort of circumvent the Palestinian issue and advance ourselves in many ways.
I'm not sure to our benefit, but that's a separate question. One quick question, though. Will Israel, between the 74th anniversary and the 75th anniversary, will we have another election?
I think so, yeah.
Mm. Not too optimistic, then.
No. Well, yeah. It depends, because we're publishing a poll this week that shows most Israelis want Bennett to go. So optimistic for a lot of people, I guess.
Right. Well, if you can't keep it together. Annie, and on the military front, you've been writing a lot lately about the West Bank operations of the IDF, trying to kind of curb the recent wave of terrorism, which continues to be costly for the state of Israel. Just this week, this past Friday, there was a security guard who was killed at the entrance to the city of Ariel in Judea and Samaria. There's now 15 Israelis who have been killed in this recent wave. But, you know, that to me always seems maybe a little more isolated. But what do you think is the greatest threat for Israel right now?
I mean, the Palestinian issue has always been a threat and always been an issue and challenge that I don't think we will ever be able to completely get under control to the point where we have absolutely no terror attacks and absolutely no rockets and no incitement by Hamas and Fatah and all the other groups sitting in Gaza and the West Bank, in Syria, in Turkey, or in Iran. And Iran is also a big threat, a major threat, much more than I think the Palestinians are, because they not only incite, not only provide weapons, they even tried to smuggle weapons to the West Bank and Gaza via drones. So they're also promoting and assisting Palestinian terrorists in carrying out attacks. I do think another major challenge that has always faced Israel, which we still haven't won the war. We haven't won the war of the hearts and minds of people abroad and who are not Jewish, and even Jewish youth abroad. I mean, I remember in university, it's been a while now, but I grew up in Montreal, and I remember Concordia University having these major anti-Israel rallies.
That's where I think Netanyahu spoke at one point, and they went crazy there, right? Breaking windows and smashing. Yeah.
My sister had a beer bottle thrown in her head, and it missed her, thank God, but it was always very scary. In university, I had an Israeli friend chased across a bridge with a machete because he was wearing a kippah and because they knew that he was Israeli. And this incitement and this hatred really is something that we've never been able to fully, get a grip on. So I think it's also a threat because that does, at the end of the day, have an effect here military-wise and terror-wise.
Herb, what's your take?
Look, as far as the, you know, as far as the hearts and minds abroad, I think we have to be realistic. You know, there was, for a certain period of time, there was this thought that, you know, in America, once Netanyahu leaves, the left in America will have a more benign attitude towards Israel. that it's about the policies, not necessarily about the state. And I think that we're seeing that that's not the case. Those anti-Zionist voices, those anti-Israel voices in America, it really don't have anything to do with the policy. It has to do with the state. You're not going to convince them. What you've got to try to do, though, is, you know, go to the hearts and minds of those in the middle who aren't ideologically anti-Zionistic and just, you know, explain to them the best that you can, you know, that a world without a Jewish state is not a world where they want to live in. That it's, you know, there's got to be room in this world as well for a Jewish state. And I think a lot of the onus of doing that, has to fall dafka on the diaspora community. They're the ones who are living there. And they're the ones who I think have to make the argument loudly, and decisively. You can throw money at the problem from the strategic or from the diaspora affairs minister, the foreign ministry in Israel. But it's the people in the diaspora, the supporters of Israel, both Jews and non-Jews, are going to have to stand up and defend Israel against this incitement.
You know, something that's bothered me for a while, and Allah, have you kind of touched on this just before it, mentioning the status quo on the Palestinians, is the fact that to me, to an extent, I feel that Israel, yeah, we're 74 years, but we haven't necessarily grown up. You know, I hear often from people in government, let's say, it's like people say this all the time, and I'm sure, Annie, you hear that in the IDF and Herb and your contacts back definitely when you were covering diplomatic affairs, but Lav, I'm sure you do now. We're still a small country. Like you talked to them about, you know, take a leap, do something risky maybe. No, but we're a small country. We're surrounded by enemies. And we are a small country. We are surrounded by enemies. We're also the most powerful country in the Middle East, militarily, economically, diplomatically. Look at what we've done over the last couple of years with the normalization and agreements with different states in the Gulf. But still, we've enshrined this idea or this notion of the status quo, whether it's the Palestinians, whether it's matters of religion and state, most recently the Temple Mount, which on the flip side of the Palestinians, where I think we need to do something to advance on the Temple Mount, I think it's ridiculous that Jews can't pray there, right? Absolutely. When it's the most holy, it's the holiest site to Jews, and Jews are now being told they can't pray there, is ridiculous because of the so-called status quo, right? We don't want to upset the Jordanians, the Arabs, the this, that. Everything is, you know, with Russia, Ukraine, we want to be careful with Russia. So we don't want to fully, you know, condemn them, even though Ukraine's right. Taiwan, China, we don't want to come out too much in favor of Taiwan because we don't want to upset the Chinese. Armenia, Turkey. Yes, we've suffered genocide. The Armenians suffered genocide, but we can't recognize genocide because we'll upset the Turks. Everything is kind of, you know, we're always trying to play both sides. It's time to grow up, take a stand, and be the powerful country that we are.
And frankly, it's like this weird kind of like, do people think that it, because we didn't say something, we're not like on whatever side America is on almost always? Like that's the other thing is like with the Russia-Ukraine war, right? Like, or with China, like if push comes to shove and it becomes like a world with two poles the way it was during the Cold War, like obviously we're with America. Like this isn't 1949. So sometimes it's like stupid too. Sometimes it's just like, who do you think you're kidding?
Why, Herb, Annie, Lahav, I mean, you jump in. Why do you feel that we're not, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being overly critical. I don't know.
Look, Yaakov, I would take issue with what you said, that Israel doesn't take chances. I think Israel has taken chances in the past, and they haven't necessarily turned out so great. You look at, you know, the unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000. You look at the withdrawal from Gaza in 2005. That's Israel, you know, taking the bull by the horns and trying to force the issue. Taking a leap. You know, people always, you know, saying Israel needs to take a leap. Well, if you're standing at the precipice of a mountain and you leap, that's not necessarily the greatest place to be. So you have to be careful in how you leap. Unless you're bungee jumping, right. you have to be careful how you leap. So I think that's what you see here. You see cautious. You see caution. And I'm not necessarily convinced that caution is necessarily bad for us right now.
Annie?
I'm a little stuck on the fence here because, I mean, not stuck on the fence like Israel is with Ukraine, Russia. But on the one hand, I do understand why Israel is being cautious diplomatically in some issues. But what I see, or I think now in terms of Russia and Ukraine, is that Russia has really gone out and has made such just utterly wrong comments, like what Lavrov said yesterday night about, you know, Hitler had Jewish blood as well. I mean, there has to be a limit to where we can be on the fence. And I think Israel, you know, that limit is Lavrov's comments, if not all the images coming out of the Ukraine.
I've been covering that story all day as we're recording this. And on the one hand, like, I was glad to see that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett came out and said that, like, you know, the Holocaust isn't just like your political tool and you can't be blaming Jews for the Holocaust. Because if you say that Hitler is part Jewish, it means that the Jews are killing themselves, right? I mean, it's just horrible. But at the same time, I'm like, well, okay, and where were you when Russia was, like, massacring thousands of civilians? Why couldn't you call out Russia then?
Exactly.
So it's this whole being on the fence thing is, yeah, I think it's backfiring.
And I think as well, I mean, if we look at the recent comments from Russia in terms of the Israeli strikes in Syria, they're also, you know, getting a bit more vocal about Israel's operations in Syria. And we've been nice and quiet and trying to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, and this is what we get. But in terms of Armenia, I want to say that there is absolutely no reason why we can't come out and say the Turks committed genocide against the Armenians in 1915. It's been more than 100 years. While Turkey is trying, you know, with the rapprochement to Israel, how genuine is that? I mean, I really have to question Erdogan's motives here. I think that it's more than enough time has passed to just come out, you know, and even if the Armenians are not our closest allies or a country that which we have amazing diplomatic ties with, a genocide occurred. What is so hard and why is it so difficult to say that?
Because I think we're always trying to play both sides to an extent. That I think that's it's a mentality in this country. And I Herb, I agree with you. We have taken risks at times, but I also think that we also have this tendency. And I don't know, you know, that's a whole other conversation where it comes from, right? Is it a Jewish exile mentality? Is it, you know, back from when we had to get along with all the non-Jewish leaders from the czar to the mayor to the governor of, you know, Ukraine, Poland, Galicia or Slovakia or whatever. Well, I'm Ashkenazi, come on. But anyhow, we try to play both sides. And I think, I mean, like, Armenia is it's insane. And not only is the sense, you know, there were 10 years that we had terrible relations with Turkey. And even then we didn't do it because we're like, maybe it will ruin our chances to renew relations with Turkey. Come on.
Meanwhile, they're hosting Hamas and, you know, one of their top commanders, Aghouli, who's been promoting right. and carrying out terror attacks and killing Israeli citizens. Right. But yeah. Okay. Be right. polite with Erdogan. Cause one day we want to be friends again with them. Come on.
I do, you know, this is about Israel's 74th Independence Day, so I want to move away from Armenian genocide for a moment and talk about something that's really controversial, okay, like super controversial in this country, and it's called fireworks. Lahav, you want to tell us what's going on with Israel and fireworks?
Yeah, so as of around a month ago, Tel Aviv, I think, was first that they announced that they're canceling their fireworks because they disturb or trigger people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. And a bunch of cities followed, saying, you know, that they don't want to bother people who have PTSD. Let's see, including cities where we probably have listeners like Ramat Gan, Herzliya.
A lot.
That's really interesting. That's like a vacation city. Yeah, so a whole bunch of towns have canceled it. Jerusalem has not.
And thank God, because I enjoy fireworks, by the way.
Right. Okay, so I have a take on this that I think is a little different from others, but I feel like in the pandemic, right, we just came out of 2 years of a pandemic, and the solution to the pandemic was constantly to take things away from children and to basically ruin 2 years of children's childhood. So, like, why is the solution to the small group of PTSD people who can find ways to hide from the fireworks for half an hour?
And let's just say that we feel for them and it's terrible and I'm sure they're suffering.
100%. But it's just like, to me, it's like, why is this solution to every problem? Oh, kids are okay. They'll adapt. They'll be fine.
No, you know what
I don't want my kids to have to adapt. I want them to have a fun Yom HaTzmaut.
You know what you could do? You could put fireworks on their iPad. And they can watch fireworks on their iPad.
Right, just like Zoom has replaced school so well, yeah. And, you know, texting has replaced a social life so well.
Annie, I know you have a bit of a different take on this.
I do think that it's a very good and meaningful step to cancel fireworks for those suffering from PTSD. I do understand as well the fact it's going to ruin Independence Day for a lot of children and their parents. I myself love fireworks. Coming from Montreal, we have a fireworks festival every summer. Every Wednesday evening, fireworks in the skies of Montreal. But here in Israel, and especially on Yom HaTzmaut, coming after Remembrance Day, there are thousands of IDF veterans who gave maybe not their lives, but their souls to this country. I have spoken to many veterans who have PTSD. One of them is a very good friend of mine who, when Independence Day fireworks would happen, would hide in his bedroom crying with noise-canceling headphones because it was that traumatic to him. And he doesn't have such, you know, awful PTSD, but that's what fireworks would do to him. And I think that it's something that we can give up. There are other ways to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut that, you know, don't have any negative effect on those suffering from PTSD.
But, you know,
we can still get together with family, but let's show a little bit of not, I wouldn't say respect, but let's show a little bit of kindness to these men and women who have been traumatized by their service to this country.
Herb, you come from Denver, Colorado. There were fireworks there, I'm guessing, on July 4th.
Look, I'm a big, big fan of fireworks. I like the who and the I, and it just, for me, that's what, you know, at least what July 4th was. I also enjoy it in Israel. Look, I'm no mental health expert, although I'm married to a psychotherapist. And my understanding, though, is the way to deal with traumatic things for people is not necessarily to remove the source. Right? There are a lot of people walking around with a lot of different traumas over many different things, and you just can't necessarily remove the source because you can't create a sterile environment. And I've heard arguments also from people who are suffering from this, you know, veterans who suffer from this, who say the same thing, that they have to cope with it because, you know, dealing with booms and backfiring from buses and cars, that's just part of everyday reality. And you're not doing them a great favor necessarily by removing it. So even among those with the trauma, you hear those who say, well, this isn't necessarily the healthiest way to go.
Yeah, I have I had a relative, a first cousin of my mother, who suffered from PTSD from the Yom Kippur War. He was trapped in a tank for a long time. And, you know, I don't know if I ever spent Yom HaTzmaut with him. I don't remember, but he was suffering from everyday things, and it's a really horrible issue that people have to deal with. And I just think that, like, this is not going to solve people's problems. I also feel like, you know, the government's now patting itself on the back because the culture minister is discouraging people from using fireworks. Like, no, don't pat yourself on the back. You're not providing these people with good enough medical and social services. That would really help them. Sparing them half an hour of difficulty is not the solution.
By the way, let's remember that it was Itzik Saidyan, the former veteran who had to set himself on fire outside an IDF veteran center last year to get the attention of the last government or get the attention of the country. Then they established a committee to try to help soldiers who do suffer from PTSD. But I also think that there is an issue here of where does this end? You know, today it's fireworks. Tomorrow, someone's going to say the mangal, the barbecue, and the secondhand smoke, and the meat, and it's not it's inappropriate to that Israelis are eating so much meat because it's hurting the feelings of vegetarians and vegans, and we shouldn't have meat on Yom HaTzmaut now. I mean, come on. One of the ways that you mark a day of celebration, a national day of celebration, is fireworks. I'm looking at my computer at New Year's 2022 in Sydney. I mean, just look over the Opera House, right, in the harbor, of the amount of fireworks. I mean, it's an international way of celebrating. Israel has the right to do it. My heart goes out to these thousands of people, but they're thousands of people in a country of 10 million people.
And by the way, there's something that's very difficult for bereaved families about the transition from Yom HaZikaron, from Israel's Remembrance Day for fallen soldiers and victims of terror, to Yom HaTzmaut, to Israel's Independence Day, which they're one day after the other, right? And some families have a very difficult time being at the grave of their loved ones, and then hours later they're supposed to celebrate, fireworks or not. And yet, for the vast majority of Israelis, I think that they see something beautiful in it, that it's showing how we rose from the ashes and how we love this country, that we're willing to defend it. And so, you know, I think that this is a question that we encounter sort of every year. And so far, we've kept those holidays one after the other.
So we will see what will happen. I don't know where each of you live will depend on whether you see fireworks this year. I think so. I'm in Jerusalem. I'll get some fireworks. Annie and Rishon LeZion, you're going to have fireworks there?
So, but even if the city doesn't have official fireworks, in my neighborhood will. So there will be fireworks someplace.
And Herb, where you live in Maale Adumim, are there fireworks?
Yaakov, I don't know. I haven't heard that they're not. So I'll imagine there might
be. Yeah, no, they're not. Okay, and Lahav Modi'in, last
yes,
but not least.
I checked. I made sure this morning when I heard about the cancellations on the radio, because it was it's the one thing that my kids would be interested in. They don't care about all these like pop stars coming. They're too little.
Yeah, I think it's something for the kids. But anyhow, thank you all for joining us. Yom HaTzmut Sameach, and happy Independence Day to the State of Israel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So in a shift from our previous topic, so I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I once a month or so write a cooking column for the magazine. I love cooking, and so it's just a fun additional
thing.
Those
who follow you on Twitter can get that sense that you like baking, at least.
Yes.
Challah, definitely.
Definitely challah. I often tweet my challah picture before Shabbat. So this week I interviewed Eitan Bernath, who is a young chef. He's 20 years old, grew up religious in Teaneck, New Jersey, went to religious schools, but has become a social media sensation with millions of followers on TikTok. And he's the cook, sort of. He does the cooking segments on the Drew Barrymore show. Super energetic, fun guy. It was really fun interviewing him, and his cookbook, Eitan Eats the World, is really cool too.
He's 20?
He's 20.
I saw the pictures from the book. Very cool.
Yeah. I mean, he looks 20.
No, but yeah. I mean, like, he has a book at that age.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I mean, he sort of first came to fame, at least, you know, among people who love Jewish geography, when he was, I think, 11 years old, because he was on Chopped, which is like a cooking competition TV show.
Okay.
And he couldn't eat any of the food because it wasn't on kosher dishes.
Wow.
Yeah. So now he has a cookbook, and he's, you know, like I said, on the Drew Barrymore show and huge, huge on social media. And so that interview's coming right up. So I'm here with Eitan Bernath, chef, very popular Instagram and TikTok figure, who has a new cookbook out in May. And came to talk to the Jerusalem Post about it. For our listeners who don't know, I have a cookbook review column where I like to make some of the recipes from different cookbooks. So Eitan's, which is coming out soon, will be my next one. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you.
So you started cooking at a really young age. Could you tell us what inspired you, that made you so interested in cooking, and when you became such a big name?
Yeah, so I started cooking when I was around 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, initially it was just kind of, I loved watching food on television, like Food Network and stuff like that. And then my mom's like, well, like, why don't you try like cooking it? So, you know, I'd always ask mom, like, oh, can you make this? Can you make this? And there were all these foods that I really wanted my mom to make, because I wanted to eat. So it kind of really just started out as like, okay, I want to eat this item. If I cook it, I then get to eat it. It was very, very practical like that. And then, you know, eventually it evolved into, you know, really loving cooking and having a passion for food and cooking. But it truly kind of just started as like, all right, I'm craving this food. If I cook it, then I get to eat it. And you know, then it evolved into, you know, I competed on Chopped when I was 11. I then and then start a food blog. And, you know, from there, I just started creating content online and eventually grew a following and then, you know, kept creating and kept growing.
So it's interesting. I was looking through the cookbook and there are foods there that I feel like when you keep kosher, and I know you grew up in a religious home, you went to religious schools, that are not so easy to find, right? Like Indian food. I don't have an example at the tip of my tongue at the moment, but definitely Indian food was a big one. And so was that the kind of thing that like attracted you, that you were saying, oh, you know, there's kosher sushi, there's kosher pizza, but there isn't kosher this, so I need to make it myself?
Yes, every recipe in Eight Tiny Eats World is kosher. And I do think one of the things I'm most excited about with the book, especially for kosher readers, is that I think there's a lot of recipes that will definitely push kosher cooks out of their culinary comfort zone. You know, a recipe that you're probably actually referring to is like the chicken tikka masala recipe in the book, which happens to be there's a whole argument about the origins of it. One of the most predominantly accepted like origin stories of it is that actually when the British Raj came back to the UK from Britain, that they like made this dish because they thought it tasted the most like Indian food. So most people believe it was actually created in the UK, not in India. But regardless of that, it's traditionally, you know, chicken marinated in yogurt. But instead of yogurt, you know, growing up, I was always looking for these like substitutes. And it turns out that coconut milk is like the perfect substitute for that yogurt. You know, it does many of the similar things. And so there's lots of little things like that, that I think, you know, kosher readers will recognize and kind of be like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That's cool. I never thought of that. And probably for other readers who aren't Jewish or have no idea about what kosher is, they probably won't even realize.
Right. Like I noticed you had a cheeseburger recipe and then it said that you were using, I think, a vegan cheeseburger, and that made sense to me as like you made it very appealing for even for people who don't keep kosher. Like it looks beautiful and it's colorful and the recipes just seem like regular recipes, while also leaving those little hints for the kosher keepers to understand how to make it, you know, kosher. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, there's so many great products there, whether, you know, it's plant-based meat or plant-based cheese. I happen to be a big plant-based meat person. I love plant-based meat. That's just my preference. But, you know, there's just so many ways, and there's no reason that regardless what your diet is, like that you can't eat these recipes. You know, I think something also that readers will realize in the book is, you know, a lot of the recipes just happen to be gluten-free. You know, it's definitely not a gluten-free cookbook whatsoever, but growing up, my mom was gluten-free. So like a lot of the food I cook just happens to not always have gluten in it. Now, trust me, there's a ton that do. There's a delicious cinnamon and chocolate babka recipe in the book. I have tons of great baking recipes, but I really do think this is a book that will work for a lot of people with a lot of different diets.
All right. And I noticed a lot of Israeli food in there. I think Israeli food has become very trendy in the U.S. I mean, not just with like Jewish cookbooks, it seems.
Oh, I mean, I could not agree more. You know, I think that for me, I mean, obviously just growing up Jewish, I love eating Israeli food because it's around, you know, when you visit Israel, everything and at home. But I totally agree. I mean, Middle Eastern flavors of all kinds have been gaining a lot of popularity. And so there's definitely a lot of that in the book, you know, whether it's like the recipe that's on the cover, my sesame schnitzel recipe, or others in the book, you know, really kind of focusing on those delicious flavors. I mean, the flavor I use a lot in the book is tahini. I love tahini. You know, so I have tahini puppy chow. I can't even talk about this water. There's a halva chocolate. Oh my god, I literally have to make this like in the next few weeks. I'm like, I haven't been in a while. A lot. The funny thing about when you talk about this, the book, is like it was like such a big part of my life for like the year when I was working on it. But then kind of when you like submit your manuscript, you need like a little mental break from it. And now that I'm back in the thick of the book, there's all these recipes. I'm like, oh my god, I need to make these again right now. So sorry, not to go off on a tangent, but there's a tahini halva chocolate cake in the book that is just absolutely to die for.
So what is your favorite recipe in the book?
Ooh, that's a hard question. I mean, that probably honestly changes by the minute, if I'm going to be totally honest with you. I think one of the most meaningful recipes in the book is probably my grandma Linda's chicken soup with my dad's matzo balls. You know, I think for me, you know, when I talk about in the book, like what is comfort food? You know, I describe the food in the 18th world as comfort food. For me, comfort food are those recipes that, you know, that you have memories around, you know, the recipes that, you know, either you go to for comfort or thinking about them brings you comfort, eating them brings you comfort. And, you know, I think for me, you know, that's the recipe that reminds me most of home. You know, I was just at home for Pesach and, you know, sitting at the Seder, eating the matzah balls and chicken soup with my family. Like, I think for me, like, that is the most nostalgic sensory experience I could think of, you know, whether it's the smell of the soup in the air, the taste, the visual of eating with my family. Like, to me, there's nothing more nostalgic and nothing that I would describe for me personally as more of a comfort food than chicken soup and matzo balls. You know, all of my greatest, many of my greatest memories were with people I love eating that soup. So I think for me, that's one that's most meaningful. I mean, but some that I think are exciting, like I have a really great croque monsieur tuna melt in there because, you know, croque monsieur is pork usually. So I was like, wow, what if I just pair it with tuna instead? And it's just like this beautiful pairing of these two dishes that should have always been paired. They're so good. There's this really good blueberry jam grilled cheese in the book because I was like, well, I love grilled cheese, but I can't just publish a boring grilled cheese recipe. So I was like, well, what if I put jam? And it was, it's delicious.
Grilled cheese is like my go-to, like when I need something quick and easy. So I'll have to try that one.
No, it's a delicious one. I highly recommend.
You've been on the Drew Barrymore show and you've been on TV a lot. Do you feel like you're representing sort of Jews, modern Orthodox Jews when you're on screen?
Yeah, no, I think something I realized pretty quickly, you know, being in the public eye, you know, I began in the public eye when I was 11, and I'm now turning 20 in a few days. And so I've been doing this now for about 9 years. I think I very quickly realized at a young age, this sense of responsibility that it comes with, you know, being Jewish in the public eye. And, you know, whether it's, you know, visually, you know, from like, let's say like the Jewish star that I wear, whenever I do appearances anywhere, like on the Drew Barrymore show or when I went to the White House or any of those things, or just literally my first name, Eitan, you know, I always feel that sense of responsibility. You know, I'm representing Jewish people. And I think something, you know, now that my videos reach hundreds of millions of people a year, I'm very aware that for most people that watch my videos, that I'm probably the only Jew or one of the very few Jews that they will ever interact with in their life. And I feel like that comes with a great sense of responsibility. You know, there's so many like despicable, evil things that people believe about Jews. And I think that, you know, every time I'm in front of an audience or people in real life or digitally on social media, I very much feel that responsibility of like, however I act is how these people are going to assume all Jews act. And so, you know, I think for me, it's always being very conscious of that. You know, I consider myself a kind person and everything, but I think, you know, especially in the public eye, I mean, I try to be extra, extra aware of, you know, how I'm acting, how I'm presenting myself, you know, making sure that, you know, my actions represent that of, you know, what Jewish values are, you know, being a kind person, a person who cares about other people, you know, someone who's the first to help if someone needs help. But I think that, for me, it's something that I take a lot of pride in, you know, I'm a very proud Jew. And I think, you know, because of that, there's that extra responsibility. You know, if my name wasn't Eitan, maybe my name was like Sam or some name that's not as Jewish as Eitan being literally a Hebrew word. Maybe I wouldn't have that same level, but you know, no matter where I am, no matter whether I'm wearing a physical Jewish identifier on me or not, I really do feel that responsibility, and it's something that I take very seriously.
Do you get reactions to it, like from the Jewish community and also from people who are not Jewish?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that's always fun are when people come up to you, like when I see like I have a Jewish star on, you know. So I was at a Gucci event. Gucci invited me to one of their New York Fashion Week event, and I was wearing like one of my big Jewish star necklaces, and a bunch of people come up to me, like, "Oh my God, I'm Jewish! Like my mom's Jewish, or my dad's Jewish, or my mom's mom is Jewish." All like whatever their story is, like, "Oh, that's so cool! Like I rarely meet other Jews." So that's always really fun. Like, you know, I think it's just like an instant connector. And, you know, even people that aren't Jewish, I think, you know, people, at least in the US and in New York, are very aware of anti-Semitism and how prevalent it is. And I think, you know, a lot of times from non-Jews, I get the reaction like, "Oh, I'm so happy that you're that you're proudly Jewish, you know, like, you know, they're aware that, like, you know, in a sense that, you know, wearing a Jewish star, wearing a Jewish identifier is in some sense, sometimes can be almost like putting a target on yourself. You know, like you're, right. You literally are statistically more likely to be hate crimed. I mean, as you know what I mean to tell you this, but I mean, in the US, Jews are the most hate crimed religious minority. And so I think, you know, for non-Jewish people, it's like, oh, I'm just like, it's so cool. I'm so happy that you are loud and proud and Jewish and you feel comfortable doing that. And I think that both types of reactions are always really fun and just spark really great conversations.
So there's a lot of weird politics these days about like ethnic foods, international foods, about, you know, people accusing each other of appropriation and things like that. Have you gotten responses like that? And sort of how do you handle that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's something that I try to be very conscious of. You know, I think it's, you know, it's a very complex issue. And I think that just like any social interaction type of issue, you're always bound to at some point mess up. And I think, you know, just establishing that, like, we're all human, we're all going to mess up. And, you know, I mean, for the most part, people love to talk about like cancel culture on those things in general, especially on social media. That's just not true. I mean, very rarely when someone is quote unquote canceled, is their career over. That's just not how it works. Right. People love to say that, but that's just not the reality of what happens. I think we're all human. We all make mistakes. I mean, for me, I try to be very conscious of it. You know, I do love cooking food for around the world. And I think for me, the approach I always try to take is, you know, really owning my perspective. You know, I'm Eitan. I love to eat these foods. I love to learn about these foods. I love to learn about the places they're from the food. And, you know, when I'm sharing the recipes, I try to be super clear that, like, I'm sharing what I've learned. You know, I'm not an expert on this. You know, when, let's say, when I'm cooking Indian food, I'm, of course, not an Indian food expert. I'm an enthusiast. I love eating Indian food. But I think for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, a few things. One, respect, making sure being respectful. And also just like being transparent, you know, being like, all right, I'm not an expert. I do love cooking this. Here's how I make it. And I think at the end of the day, it's just always making sure to give credit. You know, I feel like, so I try to think of like, all right, if I saw, you know, let's say a Christian content creator making a recipe and being like, oh, I'm making these matzo balls, like they're the best matzo balls on earth. And, you know, they make this whole video, they never mention Jews. And they make, like, I'd be like, oh, that's kind of not great. Like, like, why do you give us credit? So I try to think of it in the lens of that, you know, just being respectful, but at the same time, you know, not like being scared, not be scared about, you know, as long as you're respectful, you're bound to upset sometimes people, but I think as long as you're respectful, you know, and I think the main other point is just, you know, when and if you do mess up is, you know, listening, you know, not being defensive, saying, oh, okay, thank you for letting me know. Like, now I'll be conscious of that. I think those are the keys.
All right. Is there something that you tell or advice that you give to aspiring chefs, to, you know, young kids who want to do what you do?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think if you are just starting in the kitchen, I would say, and this sounds funny, but it's my genuine, honest answer. Start with cooking food you know you like to eat. Eating is what got me into cooking. And I think for a lot of people, it's also what gets into cooking. And what I always say is, you know, when I started out cooking, I started with the foods I love to eat. And I think the reason that's so important is because you're bound to mess up. Look, I mess up all the time still. And I've been doing this now for 9 years. But you're bound to mess up. And the way that I would say is, when you're starting out, if you start with foods that you love to eat already, then when you mess up, it's not going to be that bad. I mean, look, if your favorite food, oh my God, I can't even speak. If your favorite food is, let's say, pizza, and you're trying to make pizza from scratch, at the end of the day, no matter how atrocious you do, if you have bread, sauce, and some type of cheese, and hopefully a topping, it'll be good enough. Maybe is your dough going to be a little underdone? Maybe is your cheese going to be a little burnt or a little extra crispy? Okay, we're all human. But at the end of the day, if you start with making something that you love to eat, it'll be good enough. You're not serving this to Gordon Ramsay. You're not on Chopped. You're in your own home. And so I would say, start off with food you love to eat, because, you know, I do think it can be very discouraging when you start cooking. You know, when you mess up, it's like, oh, I put all this work in, I spend this money, everything. So start with what you like. And then once you start building up that confidence, then push yourself out of your comfort zone. You know, if you're getting to cooking, don't be like, all right, immediately, I'm going to start learning all these things I've ever made. Start with saying you like. If you love pizza, make pizza. If you love nachos, make nachos. Build up that confidence and then expand your repertoire.
And then another thing is, I mean, you're so prominent on social media, and social media can often be, I mean, you make great connections and it helps with business and things like that. But at the same time, it can often be just like horrible people bullying each other. And I mean, I know in my personal experience, I find myself like doom scrolling, right? Reading all nasty things on Twitter one after the other. So how do you stay positive?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think one thing that is super important to remember is that I always say that like the two extremes are bad on social media. Extremely positive people are bad because, you know, they can make you have a big head, and the extremely negative people can make you feel bad about yourself. And I think something that I've always tried to do for myself is remember that the extremes are bad for your mental health. You know, right now while we're talking, I could open up my phone, and if I want, I could read 100 messages of people online telling me how amazing I am. You know, oh, you're so talented, you're so amazing, blah, blah, blah. And if I read all those and I really take those to heart, you know, obviously I appreciate the messages, but you know, if I read too many of them and, you know, I think too much about it, I can become really arrogant. I mean, that's very easy to become arrogant. If you have people constantly telling you how amazing you are, it's very easy to become arrogant, which to be honest is one of my biggest nightmares. And I tell everyone around me, please, if you ever catch me being arrogant because of my job, stop me. And on the contrary to that, you know, the hate comments, and you know, whether it's for me, anti-Semitism or just random hate, like, oh, I think you're stupid. Okay, thanks for letting me know. you know, those things are also really bad for mental health because, you know, obviously, like, seeing that is just not good. So I think for me, you know, I really try to kind of focus on myself and, you know, what I'm doing. You know, it's obviously important to listen to feedback, you know, just like the cultural appropriation conversation we just spoke about. You know, if you post something and you get a lot of comments like, hey, Tom, like this really offended my culture, or this just, you know, like why don't you give credit to blah, blah, blah? Like you should listen to that. But at the same time, you always, I think it's important to just not listen to either extreme too much. And I think at the end of the day, what I try to think about, and this is something that, you know, I think Gary Vaynerchuk, a creator who's based in New York, always says that I really took to heart when I heard him say it, is I try to react to people who write hate comments with empathy. The way I try to think about it is you have 24 hours in a day. If you choose to spend your precious time during your day trying to put someone else down who's a stranger on the internet, like, think about how that person's day must be going if that's what they're choosing to do with their time. And I think that for me, I really try to just put myself in their shoes. I'm like, all right, if I was having such a bad day that in order for me to feel better, I needed to comment on someone's video telling them that they're ugly or that they're stupid, I must not be having a good day. And so, you know, whether that's sometimes I respond to people like, who write, let's say if they're like, I hate your videos, you're annoying, I'll respond, hope you have a great rest of your day, or something like that. Or usually I just ignore them. But I just really try to take with a sense of empathy. Like, if someone's taking time out of their day to hate on you, they're clearly not having a good day. It's kind of like the whole concept, usually bullies are someone who was once bullied. Like, you just don't take it to heart. It reflects everything about them and nothing about you.
Well, you seem to have a really great perspective, and your cookbook looks really just delicious and just colorful and easy to read. Eitan Eats the World comes out on May 3rd. Okay. And yeah, and all of our readers should go out and look for it. So thank you so much for being on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. A happy, happy Yom HaTzma'ut to everyone who's listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please pass it on to your family and friends. We're on all the major podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, etc. And we'll be back next week.